the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Hello, hello, welcome everyone once again. I am your host, Marty Leeds. Thanks for tuning in. I've gotten a great response to the show thus far, and I want to thank everyone for all the wonderful compliments and comments, and thanks to everyone who has shared this, and also thanks to all the guests who have taken time out of their busy schedules and offer their time and wisdom. A few notes before we get started. I was recently a guest on the podcast Our Troubled Times, and that's with host Jay Hanahan, and you can find that at ourtroubledtimes.podomatic.com, and you can just search for the show I did as well as check out the other great shows that he's done. We discussed gematria, of course, and the anatomy of the eye, the square and compasses, as well as the failure of our school systems, occulted history. We covered a lot of ground in just about an hour. I also want to announce that I will be the special guest speaker this next March 2015 in Hawaii at the River of Stars Astrology Conference. You can find all the info about that on www.theriveroftheriverofstars.com. You can purchase early bird tickets, I believe, at a reduced rate, so go there and check that out. There are many different speakers, many different perspectives that will be presented at the conference, and I'm really looking forward to giving my speeches. I will be giving two roughly hour and a half speeches and then one post-conference extended lecture, and everything will be recorded. So for those that cannot attend, the speeches will be available one way or another after the conference. So look forward to that. Okay, that is it for right now. More news coming up. Just booked some new guests and some other things are in the works. So as always, stay tuned for more math magic in the near future. Tonight's guests are Vortex-based mathematician Randy Powell, and the musical guest is the metal band Isa. This show is brought to you by The Sync Book Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Middle Chamber, and Synchronize. More information about Sync Book Press, Sync Book Radio, or Sync Book events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Randy Powell. Randy Powell is a lecturer, independent researcher, mathematician, and martial artist who has continued and expanded on the work of Marco Rodin. Marco Rodin, an autodidactic mathematician, has developed a unique brand of mathematics that is said to show how energy expresses itself mathematically. This math has no anomalies and shows the dimensional shape and function of the universe as being a toroid or a donut-shaped black hole. Randy, picking up on this work, has gone on to not only teach this math, show how this can be mapped in three dimensions, but also use this to preliminarily show how prime numbers are created. Randy gave a speech at the Charlotte TEDx conference, which was censored and removed due to what the organizers said was pseudoscience. Despite the controversy and attacks, Randy has continued his pursuit without any financial assistance or mainstream acceptance. So without further ado, let's get pious with Randy Powell. Randy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you and I have known each other for quite a while, and as we were just talking about off the air, we haven't spoken for about a couple of years now, so it's good to talk to you again. I know I've been highly influenced by vortex-based math. I mean, I even learned it by watching some of your videos, some of Marco's videos, and so thank you for that. I wanted to discuss not only the math on this, but also some of the criticisms as well, and which we'll get into. We only have an hour on the show, so we obviously can't get into too much of this, but things like we can't really discuss the history of Marco Rodin and how he discovered this and, you know, the inspiration that he had and things like that. We'll just kind of have to skip over some of that, and people can look at that later. But what I really want to go over is some of the fundamentals of this math, some of the mechanics, what is vortex-based math, some of its perceived applications, and then, you know, like I said, we'll talk about some of the criticisms. So, the first question is, Randy, what is vortex-based math?
Well, that's probably, ironically, the hardest question you could ask, because it's such a vast body of information and knowledge at this point, but I'll take a shot at it. Essentially, vortex what is called vortex-based mathematics, really to that's a name that somebody else gave it, but to myself and to Marco Rodin, I think I can safely say it's just mathematics in general, but it's a very opposite or mirror image way of looking at mathematics in general based on certain presuppositions that have just been brought into mathematics or number theory. A big one being that, the thought that numbers were just made up by human beings to count apples and oranges or whatever, wheat stocks. And of course, anyone who's familiar with reading ancient texts would realize there was a lot more to numbers for the ancients. So it's kind of ironic that we've come to this perspective that that was their, way of coming into this. Vortex-based mathematics takes the perspective that numbers are actually real and that there is actually a true base system for numbers, which we call the modular 9 or base 10 system. There's all kinds of arguments why I can go into, if anyone's interested at a certain point, about why it is this particular base. But that there is one actually true number system that defines space and time literally, so that you can get a literal grip on physics, as opposed to, or on any science for that matter, as opposed to creating an artificial model, which you then apply as an approximation based on isolated terms, which is kind of the standard approach.
So this is beyond theoretical, right? So in physics, they go to map the world, that sort of thing. Obviously, they're using mathematics and things like that. But this is something that's based on theory, where this is sort of there are no anomalies, right? That sort of thing.
Yeah, there are no anomalies. Now there are many theories attached to the interpretation of the mathematics. And some of those are better than others, I think. But the math in and of itself would be a theorem, so it would be a proof. Mm-hmm. And yes, it has no anomalies. The claim has always been if there was one single mistake or anomaly found in the mathematics, that you could throw the whole thing out.
Mm-hmm. So. What can we talk about a little bit how this works? Can you explain? I know it's hard to explain a lot of this stuff on the air. I'm sure you've had to do it before, and it's always really challenging, as I know this as well. But can you explain what is this vortex-based math? How does it work as far as the numbers? How do the numbers interact with one another?
Yeah, well, the mathematics and people who are interested can look up online. There's going to be really soon a whole explosion of new information that's coming out. I'm going to have a new website going up and actually some books coming out on this for people to tear into it. But essentially, this discovery is that arithmetic, numbers, just basic counting, or the functions of math, multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction, are essentially geometric in nature. They cannot accurately be done on a flat space or in anything that's not a three-dimensional reality, much like our own, and perhaps higher dimensional as well, but physically a three-dimensional reality. And so what the discovery is that the multiplication tables, which essentially aren't any different from addition, subtraction, or division tables from this perspective, actually fold out into a 3D shape called a torus or a donut or a toroid. And that shape is defining the fundamental primal geometry for all forms in nature, and that all complex geometries and other forms, geometries, Platonic solids, whatever, are derived from this most fundamental shape of a torus. And so mathematically, the discovery was just what no one knew before, which is that our multiplication tables on a flat imaginary plane, and they don't exist as an abstraction. But in fact, they are geometrical in that they form an XYZ coordinate system that can be used to model natural systems, because essentially it is also fractal. So it has those fractal scalar capabilities as well. But mostly the science that's been applied to it has been more in the engineering field, particularly electrical engineering, but also some other aspects of engineering, which for me is good. I mean, that's more my interest is applied sciences, though I think there's plenty to be done in the realm of theoretical and, of course, my specialty, which is kind of the mathematics and number theory. There's a lot to be done there, but we're most interested in seeing applications that can actually benefit mankind or humankind.
So the what would you call modular 9 and base 10? This, when we work with this and we unfold it into three dimensions, creates a torus. Can you explain why modular 9 base 10? What this even means?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we call it modular 9 base 10 because it's 0 through 9, not 1 through 10. So there's 10 digits, but the 0 is the 10th digit or the first digit, depending on how you look at it. And the reason why has to do with prime numbers is essentially the explanation. And I'll try to say this in a way that's as radio friendly as possible. But there are only certain numbers which can create a geometric array, if you will, or essentially can form into a torus. And any systems that can form into a torus have to be based on a prime number squared. So according to this system, the first true prime, because of my definition that a true prime must fold out into a 3D coordinate system, the first true prime is 3. And then 3 squared, of course, being 9. And that creates the first system that makes a torus, which I believe actually is the truly perfect system. One of the other things that this math allowed me to do is to identify, which some other people have noticed but not applied it in the same way, that there is, in fact, a pattern in primes. And I think you've done some work on this as well. There is a pattern in primes. And the only primes that stand outside of that pattern, which starts with the number 5, are 2 and 3. Now, according to our system, 2 is not a true prime, for one, because it doesn't fold out into a 3D coordinate system when it's squared, but also just because it's a prime by default. And other people have suggested that possibility before, too, because it's just the only, you know, 1 is the only other number before it.
And that makes sense in a way, too, because the number 2, when we graph it, is basically just two-dimensional, right? It's only when you get to the number 3 where we can actually start to look at three dimensions, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so the smallest group of anything that you can ever have is 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so 3 squared, which is 9, makes the first geometrical system in it out of its multiplication systems, the modular 9. And why I say it's the perfect system, one, because 3 is standing outside of the pattern, and so it has a uniqueness about it, but also because that torus that it creates it, on one single surface topology can encompass the multiplication series and functions of every number in the system. And that is not true of any other. So the next highest base system that you can make geometric is the modular 25 or base 26 system, and that is based on 5 squared, which is the next prime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order for you to have all your functions occurring over that surface topology, you have to have 2 toruses instead of just being able to do it on 1. And then when you go up to the next one, you have to have at least 3, and so on. There's a certain algorithm for how that works. Now, some people may argue that doesn't necessarily mean there's any problem with it. Maybe it's just indicating something deeper about its relationships. And I think all of these things need to be explored. But when it comes to physics and when it comes to physical observation, the structures that emerge from the Modular 9 system are just the ones that we observe all over nature, and those geometries as well, which are particularly the triangle, the hexagon, and the diamond. And interestingly, which we define by the numbers 3 for a triangle, 6 for a hexagon, and the 9 is the diamond. And what is interesting about that as well is that those are the only three shapes that, without incorporating other shapes, you can tile a 3D toroidal surface in, no matter what your base system is. So that would also suggest some certain unique properties that the Modular 9 system has. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is model perfection. We're trying to create the ultimate pathway of least resistance, because our numbers, not only do they reveal space or geometric extension, 3D coordinates, but they're also revealing time, which is the function quality. Okay, in math, you have two things. You have your numbers and your functions to make an equation, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So in conventional math, you have numbers, and the functions are the placeholders. So you have like 2 plus 2 equals 4, right? So the numbers change, and the functions remain still, mm-hmm. right? They're the placeholders. In vortex math, it's the opposite. The numbers are still. They form a geometric solid, but the functions are moving through the numbers like waveforms, which is actually more, to me, linguistically accurate. A function is an action, is a movement. It exists in time, not just in space. So our numbers are not only defining space, but defining time and functionality in that way. And so I believe, and my observations and the research that I've done support that whenever possible, nature is taking the simplest, is using the simplest methods of construction, even though they can form into very complex forms. But because of the simplicity and the elegance and the beauty, to me, of the Modular 9, even though Marco Rodin argues with me on this, but I'm the one who really sticks to that as actually being the system that defines perfection, even though he will tell you and any others who know me in this that no one has ever done the amount of surface topologies and other base systems that I've done. I mean, I've modeled them in every conceivable prime up to huge prime numbers and things that will make your head spin just looking at them.
Yeah, what's the furthest you've gone up as far as prime numbers to see this flesh out?
Well, I've done smaller maps. I don't even know. The largest one that I did a full map on was Modular 841, I think, which is, I don't know what that is, 20-something squared maybe? Or maybe it's, I'd have to look it up. I can't think off the top of my head. But I did 840. So, and essentially, if people are looking at our work out there or images of our toruses, if you look up Rodin torus or Abha, A-B-H-A torus on Google, and you're seeing these, and my friend and my partner Chuck, who's been Chuck Middaugh, who's done a lot of these images, has actually modeled some of the Modular 25 toruses for people to have. But for every one of those squares where you see 9 numbers in the Modular 841, you'll have 841 numbers in an extremely complex array. And what's interesting is not only do you get more numbers, but it's that much more exponential variation that can happen among those numbers and different ways that you can configure them. So I do believe that there are great applications for our work in primes, particularly when it comes to computers, because of all the computing that's done using primes, and because this does reveal a pattern that's inherent to that. And not only that, but it can take any system now that's using one prime number, and, you know, I hope I'm not throwing myself under the bus by saying it, you know, but, I mean, even our nuclear weapons, everything is coded in primes, you know. Mm-hmm. But now I'm able to take any single prime number and unfold it into a multidimensional coordinate system with extreme sophistication. So when you're thinking about things also like compression of files, being able to compress a tremendous amount of data into a single digit, all of those capabilities become possible out of this work.
You know, that's really interesting what you're saying right now, because it's basically this idea that, you know, when you look at a number, it doesn't matter whether it's a prime or anything like that, that there is almost like a universe beneath it, and almost as if the universe gave us the number to allow us to penetrate into that and sort of explore it, right? Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah,
if there's, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, within any finite amount of information, there's also an infinite amount of information. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have to be careful how we define those things, you know, because it isn't true, for instance, you and I are in different places. But even now, you're in Eugene, right, and I'm in Charlotte. Even now, with this vast distance between us, there's still a finite number of points between us. Even though the traditional argument being that there's an infinite number of points, but what that neglects is that at any given time of observation, we're looking at a particular scale. And for any particular scale, there's going to be a finite amount of points per that scale. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you scale it to another level of perception or of relativity, then you can keep scaling. Right? Mm-hmm. Just like you can, just like if you've looked at our equation, we have this doubling pattern that exists within the numbers. You can keep doubling to infinity, right? But it's not a linear infinity. It's a scalar infinity. So, so the system itself is still a closed system, a closed loop pattern.
And this would basically challenge our definition of infinity. And that infinity is, if you will, wrapped up within itself, correct?
Yeah, well, there's two kinds. I mean, there's linear infinity, which is undefined and undefinable. Mm-hmm. And I often refer a lot to this Edgar Allan Poe essay called Eureka, which is sort of his take on the unification of all the sciences. And, you know, you read it written back in the mid-1800s, and really, we don't have anything better today than what he was suggesting there. And, you know, he goes into a lengthy argument in that essay about why there is no such thing as a linear infinity that we can even conceive. It cannot be conceived of. I mean, we can imagine point after point after point after point, right? But eventually, we have to give up, right? We're always only imagining finite. But infinity can also be determined as a closed infinity, or what we call an infinity of duration and not direction. So it's a spin continuum. You know, it's a relativistic closed physical system. And the difference is energy. All right, in our math, we clearly define two interlocked necessary systems that always exist, but they are not to be confused with one another. And those systems can be defined as one being a closed system, which is matter, okay, or even electricity would fall in that. Anything physical is going to fall in that system, which never moves in a straight line, always warps and curves, always converges back to where it diverged from, right? And mm-hmm. that is just logically a necessity, okay? And a lot of people get tripped up on that, but they don't realize matter in and of itself, the universe, even as it is a physical universe, must be finite. In other words, it must be physically defined. Otherwise, it couldn't be measured and it wouldn't even exist.
Exactly, yeah.
Physically, right? So in order for anything physical to exist, it has to have a boundary. It has to have a boundary condition. It has to have a surface topology. It has to have a 3D matrix that it's operating on, but that's going to be a closed system. Whereas the world of energy, I like to call it spirit. People can call it magnetism, energy, you know, flux fields, all these different names for it, the Akashic record or the ether. We call it the etherons. Energy is that linearity, and that is essentially, we can define it as it is intersecting with the physical world, or as it is essentially manipulating and moving the physical world. We can define it in that regard, but we cannot define it in and of itself, and even physics has failed to do so. I mean, even E and E equals MC squared is sort of an undefined.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Can we talk a little bit about, so you had mentioned earlier, well, one thing I want to point out is you had said earlier something about the effect that the complexity of nature springs from this simplicity. And I completely agree with that. And I think that all we have to do is look in nature and see that. We can see this with fractals. When you start out with a simple, you know, geometric form, you give it, you know, a billion iterations or whatever it is to it, and then it grows into this complexity. You see a seed the seed falls into the ground. It's just basically this little walnut or whatever, and then it grows into this complex tree, this ecosystem in and of itself. And what this math shows with this base 10 is how that is done, right? If you will.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes you from a very simple group of elements, primordial elements.
Which would be the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, right?
Exactly. Because in this system, a number, much like an energy, it can never be created or destroyed. Mm-hmm. They are essentially eternal and outside of time. So they're the primal archetypes from which everything is constructed or built. But I like to even go a step further, even beyond that, which is just a very logical logical necessity, which is for logic to exist. Okay, now people could take another perspective on this, but I'm going to say if we live in a logical world, and if we don't, and there's no reason to even study science, what we call science, right? Mm-hmm. Because nothing would be predictable or repeatable. It wouldn't have a logic or a set of rules that it was obeying by. It would simply just do different things all the time, and then science would have no meaning. So in order for science to have meaning, there has to be some kind of causality in effect in the world. And causality leads us to the necessary conclusion that, and even in science with the Big Bang or with these different theories, they've come to this place, which is that ultimately everything had to start as one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the primal fundamental number that everything builds from is one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything has to begin at, and there's nothing simpler. There's nothing, by definition, there's nothing simpler than one. It is the simplest thing that can possibly exist.
And in one respect, the number one can create every other number in creation, right? Because all you'd have to do is just keep adding one, right?
In the physical world, particularly, mm-hmm. This is true. I don't necessarily want to speak on the spiritual or energetic world in terms of that, but in the physical world, oneness is an absolute is a necessity. So in that sense, when we're talking about geometry, complex physical, chemical, biological constructions, we're not talking about a bunch of separate elements that through different processes slammed into each other and then formed something else. That's a totally wrong way to look at it, because those elements had to, in the beginning, and of course the scientists are telling us the same thing, they're just not being consistent with themselves, they all emerge from this one explosion of plasma, you know, primordial matter, heat, right?
Yeah.
That eventually cooled down into these different elements, which are essentially different geometrical shapes, different geometrical forms that have, affinities and aversions for each other in different situations, and that's essentially what we call chemistry. But what we're really looking at with all of this is not a construction from elements, but it is a process of division from an essential unity,
mm-hmm.
right? In order to even get to the elements.
And this division from the unity we see in vortex based math directly, right? So basically, if I may, the idea is to put it very simply, you put nine numbers around a number dial, and you by separating certain numbers, for instance, 3, 6, 9, and then the numbers 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5, 1. Well, when you first start on that one, right, you can either multiply or divide in that first instance, and it's basically, you'll always come back to the one. It will be this infinite loop that always comes back to the one. So not only philosophically do we see this, not only do we see this in just the material world with the creation of our universe, but now here's a way to model it, right?
Exactly. And also we have to learn not to get too caught up in our own perspective and to see things from the only unified perspective we could see. In fact, Edgar Allan Poe, in that essay I mentioned, says this very appropriately, that just the mere fact of our forward perception eliminates us from being able to perceive most of reality as it's going on. That the only way that we could ever fully take in an accurate view of reality was to spin around on our heels so fast that everything would blur into one 3D, 360 panorama.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're able to do with vortex math, because it's very difficult for us to do that physically on our own. But with vortex math, we're able to do that numerically to create this 3D panorama. And what it reveals is that whether we're talking about doubling, multiplication, right, mm-hmm. or halving, which is a division process, it's actually the exact same thing, because they're both starting from the one. So I'll give you an example. If you talk about cell division, you start with one cell, which becomes 2, and then 4, and 8, 16, 32, 64, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is how we come into the world. So doubling is a very personal connection for us all, because we all came to this moment through doubling.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if we're starting as one cell, I mean, what is happening there? Is that cell dividing in half, or is it doubling, right?
It's doing both, right?
It's the same thing, right? So in other words, it's just a matter of perspective as to how you're looking at it, that all these functions are simply, they're all existing all at the same time, but it's simply a matter of which facet of the crystal are you looking at, or which facet of the crystal is defining your perspective, because that's essentially really what numbers are facets in a crystal that allows light, energy, sound to penetrate through it and to make it come to life.
Yeah, it's interesting when you were talking about this, whether it's multiplication or division, it's basically the same thing. And we see the reflection in multiplication and division. And you actually see this in Homer's Iliad, where he's talking about the great creator being, and he's saying, I divide, but that which I divide, I multiply. I thought that was really interesting, because it's like, well, shit, man, I think he's talking about math, And then there's also the Hermopolitan mystery, where he says, I am the one that becomes the two, that becomes the four, that becomes the eight, that becomes one again. And so you see this, what we find in vortex-based math, this reflection of multiplication and division. Not only do we see it in the Hermopolitan mystery and Homer's Iliad, but another place two other places that I noticed it in was Pascal's triangle, which he was a 17th century mathematician, and which I'm sure you've seen as well. And then it's actually in the one side of the Tetractus as well. So we see this. So this is when people think, oh, we want to dismiss you or Marco Roden. This is just some numerological crap or whatever. Well, it's like, okay, well, no, okay, you can maybe make that claim, but then here's Pythagoras showing it. Here's Hermes showing it. Here's Pascal, etc. So this is not just the whims of Randy Powell and Marco Roden, right?
Well, sure. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to it. Yes, it's in all these different number patterns. It's in the Fibonacci and the phi ratios and pi and all these conundrums. And yes, it does penetrate through all those different mathematical issues, including primes and others. And yes, it is hugely prevalent in the ancient writings, the Greeks, the Egyptians. I was recently in Egypt, and even the Egyptologist that I was traveling with was astonished at the connections that I was pointing out to him from Egypt and this mathematics. And of course, one of my favorites with the Vikings and the ancient Norse legends, their obsession with the number 9 is almost greater than any other culture that I've seen. And they get very deep into talking about enumeration and how it occurs. But it's everywhere. It's the Taoists. You know, if you look into the Forbidden City in China and how it's all constructed based on nines, and then of course where our work was originally derived from, the Abjad numerical system in Arabic, particularly this was coming out of the Baha'i faith in the Islamic tradition, which you know, Marco's a Baha'i. It was another place where this obsession with the number 9, this obsession with these particular mathematical patterns was clearly there, and led to the development of this equation. So, yes, it exists all over the place, but is agreement an argument for truth? For me, not really. You know, what initially compelled me to this was the fact that there were some results. You know, a technology had been created and there were some results. And I also found the coherence of the numbers very intriguing and beautiful. But at this point now, I guess some 6 or so years later, or 7 years later, however long it's been, you know, I have gathered so much supporting scientific data and mathematical proof that the applications just can't be denied. And even at the very least, were the physics to be in a nascent stage or to have a lot of issues, no one can doubt its applications to digital technologies and to computers. I was even fortunate. You know, I went out to Silicon Valley to present for some very large companies. I'm not allowed to say who because I had to sign NDAs on all that stuff. But I presented at the major companies out there, and I learned an interesting lesson when I was out there, which is that if you want to meet people in Silicon Valley, just don't even go to Google or YouTube or Facebook or, you know, any of these places, Yahoo. You just go to the Starbucks next door, and you just go up to people's tables and start talking to them, and that's what Marco and I did. And we ended up meeting the guy was like the number 2 guy for LinkedIn and a very savvy computer genius, and he was impressed with what we had to say, and so he invited us out to dinner. And we went out to dinner, and we clearly had to go out back and clear off the ping pong table and get out these giant sheets of paper. Because he was saying that the mathematics that I was describing to him were impossible, and it took me about 10 minutes to do it on paper for him, and it just blew him away. So, you know, for me, who am I? I'm nothing. You know, I'm a restaurateur and a martial artist, you know, and a knucklehead basically. I have pushed as far as I have because I just have some sort of a talent with the pattern recognition. I mean, I think that's really my big contribution to this, is I just have the visual capability of seeing things that elude a lot of other people in this math. I also attribute that to a large degree on my training in martial arts and having an actual just a discipline and a method for how I do things, which is always based on applying fundamentals and basics before you ever go complex. Mm-hmm. So I push forward in the work for those reasons, but I'm not a physicist. You know, I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a technical expert in any of these fields. I have learned a tremendous amount about electrical engineering in the last many years, but I'm not a professional in any of these fields. But I can say that in going around and meeting with them, though I get beat up all over the blogs and the internet, even though I've always challenged all my critics to have public debates that would be posted online, and none of them have ever accepted, including the board of TED or any of them. That all aside, you know, the fact that so many of these experts in their different fields, when we're face to face, I've had people get mad and yell at me and storm out before ever letting me finish saying even simple things. But whenever anyone who ever went the distance with me, even for an hour or two, getting down on paper, they've always left with a new insight and a positive perspective on me. You know, so I was in many ways maligned by Ted and some of the bloggers, even though I didn't even know what Ted was when I spoke at Ted. I was invited, you know. I was invited to go. I had no idea what Ted was. My friend said it was a cool thing. You know, Ted wasn't as big then as it is now.
Sure.
But, you know, they coached me to do this whole – I had all this peer review, and I was, like, ready to give this technical talk. My original paper for them was 10 pages. What I said on the TED program was about a page and a half. Mm-hmm. They told me to cut out all that stuff. Don't worry about the technicals. Don't worry about the peer review. Just present the big idea and do it in an exciting way and talk about its ultimate implications, and then, you know, and that's what we want, right? So that's what I did, and then they got all mad about it because they said it was supposed to, you know, this wasn't academically verified. I said, well, you guys didn't say you wanted an academic talk. You know, if you were telling me to talk in a very controlled, precise, and academic way, I would have said different things. You know, so they kind of threw me, and then I had no idea that it was going to, you know, blow up online like it did and become this sort of, you know, get these millions of views and stuff to where it just got so big. But, you know, that's caused a lot of problems for me in terms of having people actually hear me out and be willing to go into a lot of this stuff and what the results that we really have, both physical results but also mathematical results. So, I mean, I just say with the critics, you know, I mean, my phone number is online. Anybody can call me, and I'm always open to public debates that don't have to be unfriendly. I prefer that they are friendly and done just for the sake of advancing everybody's knowledge. I mean, my response to a lot of the people who are so critical but unwilling to debate is just that if my logic, if my work is so fallacious and misleading, you know, it should be a service to the public to have this conversation so that we can sort it out and so that people can move on.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that they refuse not really because they think that I'm right. It's more that they know that they have no idea either and that everybody's taking shots in the dark. And anyone who's intelligent enough and well-read enough, you know, would be able to point out the flaws and weaknesses of their own perspectives, and that's what they don't want to be shown. Because even if I'm not proven right, everyone would leave realizing that we all don't really have a clue. So one's just as good as the other. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Since we're on TED Talks, let's talk about this a little bit. You know, Gabriel Roberts, he's been on the show. He just did this beautiful, short and concise piece on TED Talks. I think you read it as well. But he was basically just like sort of like tearing down the, you know, unbreakable intellectual pillars that is TED. You know, TED has like kind of like self-appointed themselves to be like the arbiter or truth, or, you know, the purveyor of truth, or what, you know, the purveyor of what is good and true science. And you know, as you were saying, it's like, you know, There's so many flaws in everyone's argument, and any idea, like you're presenting an idea, a very grand idea, and you know, you can't flesh that idea out in 10 minutes. It's just impossible, and that's basically the time that you had. And any reasonable person knows this. So the attacks online, I think, are really kind of silly in one way, but
an extremely unfair standard. And I'll give a very clear example. Sure. Right. Relativity, right? It's considered, you know, it's still like the biggest theory, and you know, Einstein is still this revered figure amongst most people. It took over 50 years for even a modicum of experimental proof on relativity.
Mm-hmm.
Even the tiniest bit. It took over 50 years, okay? But overnight, Einstein was a celebrity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Way before any of that ever happened. Okay, and then of course, what are the technological applications that we've gotten out of it? As our friend Garrett Lisi said when he was talking about CERN, that I thought was so funny. He goes, "We don't know the technological applications that are kind of come from the Higgs boson." He goes, like, just like we didn't know the other technological applications that would come out of particle physics, like the atom bomb and nuclear fission. Yeah. I was like, so those are your examples of the awesome, you know, the past 100 years of Nobel Prizes given to people spinning atoms and other subatomic particles, and all we got was an atomic bomb and nuclear fission, both of which are about to destroy the Earth. Yeah. You know, so basically nothing really all that beneficial. But either way, you know, I didn't think that anybody was coming up to Einstein after he published his first paper going, "Where's your A-bomb, buddy? Like, why isn't it done?" You know? Yeah. It's just an unrealistic standard to hold anyone to. You know, I'm a mathematician. I did mathematical work. I made certain claims, and people have, without even making an attempt to really investigate either the mathematical claims or the engineering claims, have proclaimed themselves experts in the field, and proclaimed that if my poor ass and my bare hands a flying saucer to save the world, then I must be a charlatan, you know. But I don't see that standard being held to anyone else in the mainstream world.
And how could you even make that comparison or hold that standard to? It's like, how much money is going into vortex-based math now? None. Yeah, right? How much money is spent at the Large Hadron Collider? What, $10 billion? And what, this is what's so funny to me is like, okay, they built a $10 billion particle accelerator on a theory that's missing 85 to 90% of the mass of the, you know. It's like, okay, here's mathematics that's 100% sound, has no anomalies that anyone can do, and no one's spending any money on it, and yet they're, you know, spending $10 billion in this particle accelerator. And this is what's construed as, quote-unquote, good science.
Well, and we have direct applications, and that's the thing. I listened to a whole long program on NPR one day on like Science Friday about CERN, and it was one of the lead researchers from CERN, and it was great because I think the interviewer didn't realize, and he goes, at the end of the interview, he's like, "Well, this has just been fascinating." He goes, "So tell me, what are the applications to this amazing research?" And the guy goes, "Oh, there's no applications." And the interviewer was stunned. He was like,
"Oh, what?"
And he goes, "No, of course not. This is just research."
Wow.
So, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars for research, right? But, you know, I've only ever been looking for a lab, maybe a tech or two, and, you know, because I'm talking about electrical coils, and I'm sorry, but I'm not going to go out online and encourage a bunch of amateurs. No offense to any of them. They're all wonderful people. All the people putting stuff on YouTube, they're all my friends, and there's none of them that I have a problem with, whatever they're doing. But it's dangerous.
Yeah, sure.
Dangerous to go to high energy levels without safety protocols and all this. And, you know, we've been able to produce great results at tiny energy levels and defy the laws of physics on multiple occasions. And there are universities investigating that now, mostly overseas, that are confirming that data. So I am getting slowly technical results back. But even that university, which is over in Portugal, they started testing it. Then they said the tests were defying what they taught at the university, so they stopped. They refused to do it, and then finally they recontacted and said no, they were interested in going forward again because this was really significant. So, there's very little that's ever been asked in order to do this. We've just been trying to get information out to people. I've been working with some people over the past, you know, half a year or so, who are interested, and it's just so hard for people to comprehend the level of work that's gone into it. And I finally had to take a guy and bring him to my house and just show him. I mean, stacks of paper that are like up to the ceiling of data, mm-hmm. math work, all this stuff, and he was blown away. He said, "I can't believe that this isn't documented." And I said, "Well, it is, but it need, you know, I mean, I'm so busy trying to survive work. I'm running, you know, several jobs and, you know, family and all this stuff, that without some kind of a funding apparatus, there's just no way that it's so difficult for me to organize that level of information with no help whatsoever and amidst everything else." So, but I am going to be releasing releasing a lot of that stuff, and I'll just have to talk people through it.
I read the TED Talks rebuttal after they removed your speech, and they had said something. Actually, I have it here. Hold on. It says Randy Powell was given several opportunities to directly defend his work. This is from TED, but did not do so. In a phone conversation with members of TED and TEDx teams on September 12th, Powell stated that his brief onstage talk at TEDx Charlotte did not include complete data on his work, and you had already addressed that. He could not point us to the data online during the call, but agreed during the call to email TED his data, including a detailed 10-page paper for a further independent review. What do you have to say to that? I mean, is there any reason that you didn't send him this stuff, or you did? I mean, what do you?
Well, I wish that there was a recording of the phone call that took place, because I would love
to hear it.
There was about 10 people present. All the board members of the local TED were there, and several of the members of the national TED were on the phone. Right now, it took me over 6 months to get that call from the time that they censored my video. So let me just say that up front. It took me 6 months to get them on the phone, and they didn't even know I was going to be there. They thought they were just talking to the board. When they found out that I was there, they immediately got very reactive and very emotional. So I went through point by point. I asked them what their criticisms were. Every single criticism, I was actually excited. I was hoping for some intelligent people, like a strong debate. They didn't know anything, and they couldn't back up any of their own points. So I made them back out of every single one of their criticisms and admit that at the very least, if they were criticizing me of that, then they would have to criticize a whole handful of other TED Talks. You know, sure. Just a simple example. They said, well, there was no experimental data that confirmed what I was saying. First of all, that's not true. But second of all, then I said, well, but you had Brian Greene do a talk on string theory, and there's zero experimental data that confirms string theory.
Literally nothing.
Literally nothing. And she said, well, yeah, but he teaches at a university. So I said, well, so is that the criterion? Do I have to teach at a university? Well, no. So we went on. I mean, this was over an hour and a half conversation where I systematically dismantled every argument they had until they said, and many people left TED over this because it was so outrageous. So finally they just said, it doesn't matter. We just do whatever we want to do, and it's our choice, and this is not going to change it. It doesn't have to be a reason for it, right? So at that point I said, okay, well, that's fine. I even asked them after all that. I said, look, you guys misled me about what you wanted me to say. Then you criticized me for it. I said, why don't you just give me a chance to do another talk if what you want is an academic talk, right? A very controlled, precise, data-oriented talk. I said, yeah, it'll be a little more boring, but I'll do it, mm-hmm. You know? And I won't say anything that's not factually correct and proven so. And so they said, no, absolutely not. You'll never have a chance, blah, blah, blah. So we went on this whole thing. So finally at the end, I said, okay, well, that's fine. I said, I just want you to know that at the time we were working on this Randy's Donuts film, I said, well, we're making a film about this, and we're going to expose the story, you know, and interview people involved. And when I said that, they all of a sudden, they just changed. They were like, well, wait a minute, you know, because they knew how popular the talk was, mm-hmm. and how many people were, you know, upset about it and all this stuff. So then they didn't want me to do that. So then they finally said, okay, well, we will consider reviewing a paper, right, and taking your data, because they were claiming that the peer review people we had didn't exist. They were just going off the most base level, like Google forums of people who don't even know what they're talking about. And in fact, in that forum where they were claiming that Russell Blake didn't exist for Microsoft, his brother actually got on there and showed who he was and how he existed, you know. So anyway, they didn't even take the time to read down that far. So they said, okay, we'll let you do this paper, and you can submit the paper, and then we'll consider letting you redo the talk, because I actually wanted to. I thought it would be good for me to have a talk too that would be acceptable for academics. And And so at that time, right after I left, I went to LA to work on this film project and work on some engineering projects I had going out in LA. And I was gone for like a month. I was traveling on the road for a month. And my plan was when I came back to write the paper and send it in to him. And when I got back, I was Googling around doing some initial research, and I saw that exact letter, which had been posted. And there was, first of all, never several attempts. There was only one conversation that was ever had, and no attempt was allowed until I threatened to expose them. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, all these witnesses were there to confirm this, and then even though it took me 6 months to get a phone conversation, I had to have my paper on their desk apparently by the end of the week. So at that point, when I saw that letter, without any attempt to contact me, even though I told them I was leaving town, I was, you know, then I just knew that they had made their mind up already, and it just really wasn't worth my time, and I was very busy anyway, so I just didn't have any interest in it anymore.
Yeah, they didn't really have any interest in, yeah, looking at what you actually had to say, right?
Right. I mean, and I told them, any of the bloggers, we could do a public debate, we could do a TED conversation, we could do a round table. I said, whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah. TED looks to, as you were saying, you know, they had mentioned, it's like, oh, well, you know, this guy, you know, well, Brian Greene, he teaches at a university, so therefore, you know, he's got some clout or whatever. One of the criticisms, I just want to read this, because this comes from... This is a university professor, mind you, the people that are listening to this. And this comes from Jay Wacker, and he's a Stanford professor of theoretical physicist, a particle physicist. And he was commenting on your TEDx talk, and it says, "Wow, such fucking bullshit. Well, I am a theoretical physicist who uses and teaches the technical meaning of many of the jargon terms that Randy is throwing out. And he is simply doing a random word association with the terms. Basically, he's either insane, a huckster going for fame or money, or doing a hoax on TED. I bet it's equal parts one or two." Well, I must say, when I read that, I was like, okay, there's nothing scientific about what he was, you know, what he was saying whatsoever. He was just basically throwing out a bunch of ad hominems. And I'm like, okay, so this is the guy that people are supposed to go to for good science, and yet you're full of shit.
Yeah, I mean, where in there was I asking for money or doing, you know, I mean, I've never asked for, I've never made any money off of this, you know, so I don't know who I'm, you know, who I'm selling to or what kind of, you know, an audience, but yeah, exactly, that's all I ever got. That's all. When the TED, I actually asked them to read to me the blog criticism that they made a decision, and it was just a guy making fun of me. He never made a technical criticism of anything that I said. Mm-hmm. The only technical, I'll tell you, there's one technical criticism that I will concede to that was really just throwing out a word, or just sort of making an analogy that I didn't really mean literally, was somebody criticized me for saying that a tornado was more powerful than an atom bomb. And, you know, I was just sort of throwing that out as a figurative statement, like meaning that it was really destructive, you know? And so I guess, yeah, if you measure the joules or what, you know, I mean, you know, so, okay, I'll concede to that as to something that I said, but that's as far as anyone's gone to make any kind of technical criticism about what I'm saying.
Well, in order to make a technical criticism as well, you would have to learn the math and then therefore go and say why it's incorrect. Now, I mean, I know it's, you know, VBM has personally affected me, you know, very deeply, and I went and learned the math, and I was like, the first thing I was like, you know, was thinking was like, how are people just dismissing this? And then basically the only comment I ever heard was, well, it's numerology. And that was it. That was the argument. I'm like, that's not an argument, you know? That's not some scientific invalidation or point-by-point analysis of what's being said. And this is why
haven't read the paper by Russell Blake where it's translated into matrix algebra, which, you know, if you talk to a lot of conventional mathematicians, a lot of them believe that algebra is sort of the unifier of the different maths anyway. Mm-hmm. And right there, our math has already been translated into academic languages. But none of these people take time to do any research. They're worse than your worst internet trolls. They simply have their mind made up. I mean, read the article that the Harvard Business Review did on me. It was just making fun of me. You know, there's nothing of substance in any of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and yet I'm being treated as the irrational one, when all along I've been very, I think, calm and reasonable about it for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's amazing after all these attacks that you can still just remain calm and stuff like that. That's the one thing that I find really interesting, so, and very commendable. But, so.
I mean, I spar twice a day. That helps get it out.
Yeah, exactly. We're about out of time here, Randy. Is there anything that you want to leave the audience with, what you're doing next, how to get a hold of you, how to support VBM, where to learn it, that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. Well, people can reach out to me on email. My email is fluxfreak9. It's FLUXFREQ9, like the number 9, at Yahoo. And you can send me emails there. I'm also on Facebook, Randy Powell. You can find me on there. I will be, you know, that's a good place kind of for updates. I'm working on a website, but I can't give the information on that just yet. We're just kind of getting that stuff up. We're going to be doing some podcasts and math classes, and also putting out some books for people to get to really start learning this math. The videos that I have up online are many, many years old now, and they were sort of done when I was first kind of coming across a lot of this stuff, and there's a tremendous, tremendous gap that's gone on since then that just has never been published, though we've tried. We've gone to conferences, I've spoken, but in these kind of formats, radio shows, conferences, very difficult to get people further. You know, everybody's just sort of starting from the beginning. So that's what I hope to do with the website, archive all that stuff, and get people in a position to really be learning more. But I'm always open to communicate. You know, you can find me on Skype, too, at the same address, FluxFreak9. I'm always open to talk to people. I do get a lot of messages, a lot of emails, I apologize if I'm not always on top of it all, but I'm doing my best, and hopefully soon, you know, I'll have some assistance and we'll be able to keep going with that. But, you know, I enjoyed the show a lot, Marty, and I know that there was a lot of other things probably that we didn't have a chance to get into, and I know we'd wanted to go into some of the peer review and some of the different things, but maybe we can do it again another time.
Oh, we'll definitely do it again, man. If I keep this show going, I definitely want to have you back on and maybe get Marco on too and do, you know, I'm hoping maybe within the next 6 months, a year, start doing a 2-hour show, you know, if that works out. And so, yeah, let's get you back on and let's really hammer home some of these things and really talk about some of these things. So, check out. For the listeners, check out Vortex Based Math, and, you know, like I said, check out your videos. I learned a lot from them. It really helped me understand the stuff, and so I really appreciate that. And like I said, it's been very influential to me. I write about it in all 3 of my books, and so, you know, people, check this out, and don't just go to some, you know, science website or something like that that says, oh, this is a bunch of horse shit or whatever. Look at this stuff yourself. Go through that math yourself and do it yourself, because the person that's going to validate and verify this stuff is you, not some scientist who's sitting on some throne in some university somewhere. So, Randy, thanks for coming on. Let's talk again in the future.
My pleasure, brother.
Thanks, man. Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Sam the Butcher, and it's from the metal band Isa from right here in good old Eugene, Oregon. Unfortunately, this band is no longer together, but I wanted to play this track because not only is it just a ripping tune, but I also know that Randy is a huge metal fan, so it was just a perfect fit. You can check out the guitarist Isa Koberstein's new project called We Have Guns, as well as the tracks from Isa's first 2 records on ReverbNation.com. We Have Guns also plays all around Oregon, so if you're into heavy metal, be sure to check it out. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour include interviews with author of China's Cosmological Prehistory, Laird Scranton, poet Holly McNish, and author of The State is Out of Date, Gregory Sams. Make sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.